Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a look at a number of measures that have been unveiled in the first week of the state legislative session, including a push to eliminate the Zion Curtain and a call for the president to rescind the Bears Ears National Monument. Also, body cam footage is released from a high-profile police shooting. Salt Lake City stands up to the Trump administration over immigration enforcement policy. And Utah House Speaker Greg Hughes has his name dragged into the John Swallow case. Joining me for this discussion, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Roger.
Also, courts and government reporter Tom Harvey. Thanks for being here. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. Hello and welcome to you as well.
Happy to be here.
Listeners, you can join the conversation during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Post your questions and comments to sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. A big news week. The 2017 state legislative session kicked off on Monday, and some things are now coming into focus. And maybe before we go into some of the specifics, either Dan Harry or Robert Gerke, can we look at what the major topics we're expecting to see lawmakers address this year are? What's just a list of the sort of perennial big issues and issues that are maybe new this year, Dan?
A new one this year that has taken stage early in the session is homelessness. That's been a big focus of late because of what's going on in Salt Lake City with some new homeless sites. And the speaker, Greg Hughes, kicked that off in his opening speech and talked about how this is a statewide problem. It's not a city problem. And the city was awfully glad to hear that because, you know, they are feeling like they are shouldering the brunt of this. And for the legislature to say, yeah, we're going to take ownership of this as well, I think was good news for them. Also, kind of a major issue this session is a ballot initiative that's looming in the background to raise state income tax so that that money would go to schools and give it a really big boost for the first time in many years of about $750 million.
And it sounds like lawmakers aren't certain what to make of that ballot.
Lawmakers always hate ballot initiatives. They're jealous of their power. And this is a ballot initiative is something that goes around the legislature. So they always fight these initiatives. And they're opposing this one. So we'll see how that ends up. It could mean that they try to strike some compromise, raise taxes or revenue in other ways, and put that money into education, but we'll have to see.
You know, as the session kicked off, there was a big rally up at the Capitol that came on the heels of the massive Women's March on Washington. Ralliers calling for equal rights, rejecting degrading comments made by now President Donald Trump. Dan Harry, was the intent of this rally to send a message to state lawmakers as well? And what was that message?
Well, I'm going to kick this over to Robert because he was there and he was observing that and wrote about it. So,
yeah. Well, I think obviously there's a backlash against the Trump administration nationally. We saw it in the, you know, in the march in Washington and in other cities. We saw it a march in Park City. This one on the opening day of the session, I think, was, I mean, I've been up there, I think this is my 15th session, and this was the largest by far that I've seen there. It was pretty striking to see. I mean, they said they estimated about 6,000 people, but there were also, you know, hundreds of people sort of coming and going, sort of, you know, cycling through as the rally went on. They are trying to send a message. I think they're trying to, and I think the most interesting thing is I've heard in over the last few days is that they're trying to keep those people involved in the process and make sure that they just, that it's not just showing up on Monday, that they're showing up every day of this legislative session to ensure that the legislators know that they're not going to be silent about these issues that they care about. And I think, you know, we'll see how that plays out going on. But I think if they are involved, if we do have sort of a mainstream pro-Trump pro-woman voice at the legislature. It's something that maybe has been lacking over the last several years.
Well, the makeup of the legislature is mostly male, 76% male, mm-hmm. As a matter of fact. That's better than the U.S. Congress. But is that, I mean, it seems like an obvious barrier to what women who rallied at the Capitol might want to accomplish, or could be a barrier.
I think it is. But there are enough women there to sort of raise the issues that they care about, pay equality. Although it's oddly enough, Senator Jake Andrig, who is looking at running a pay equality bill. Representative Angela Romero has a parental leave bill. And she has bills dealing with processing rape kits, and these are issues that are important. And I think if there's a big grassroots movement to push these bills during the session, it certainly helps their chances of passing.
You wrote that in conservative circles, conversations about so-called women's issues can bog down in debate over abortion, reproductive rights, birth control. But you mentioned, and some of them you've already just mentioned now,
yeah.
other areas where maybe that bogging downing.
Well,
avoided.
Where there's daylight and potential to actually make some progress. I mean, look, in Utah, you're not going to score big victories in the conservative Republican legislature on reproductive rights. But as I mentioned in the column, Angela Romero's bill about parental leave that's something that most states have. I think it's close to 40 states already have a parental leave law. Donald Trump, of all people, is actually proposing paid parental leave, and Utah is one of the few states that doesn't have paid parental leave for state workers. And so, you know, there is some daylight there for women who care about these issues to make some progress on this. And the issue, obviously, I probably don't even need to say this, but the issue with parental leave is women usually do well early on in their careers, but once they have children, they tend to drop out of the workforce, partly because of childcare costs, but partly because they don't have the parental leave and they've got to, you know, it's hard for them to get back into the workforce after having children. So you provide those opportunities for them to remain in the workforce, and you can actually make a dent in that wage gap, which Utah's is 70 cents on the dollar, women to men, and it's one of the worst in the country.
And there is, you said, an initiative that's been unveiled or that is in the works on parental leave.
Angela Romero has had a bill the last two sessions on parental leave. Last year, it didn't get through committee. There were concerns about, well, we're going to have lost productivity, and that'll cost the state more money. So that got shelved. She's bringing it back this year, and she's hopeful that she can get that through. It doesn't necessarily cost the state up front, but it does. There are some concerns about lost productivity because the women who are or men in the case of this bill who would be taking that leave would end up with missing work, and they'd have to bring in people to take their spots. So,
Dan Harrington,
can I just say that there will be an effort tomorrow to steer the conversation back to reproductive rights, and there's a big pro-life march to the Capitol. It'll be interesting to compare the numbers in those two crowds. We've had a lot of crowd comparisons in the last week, and so it'll be interesting to compare this one too. They're doing it on a Saturday. The legislature won't be there, so they will be marching up, I guess, just to the empty Capitol and giving speeches and so forth. But We'll look forward to seeing how that turnout is.
Well, every rally is always the largest rally that ever happened. So
I think that Robert was right that this one was beyond what we've ever seen up there.
There were some really big rallies over the immigration issue several years ago, and when the legislature
teachers
tried
a couple
to,
of years ago,
the
too.
Teachers always draw several thousand, and then when they tried to repeal Grandma. Or rewrite grandma law, the open records law. There were big rallies then, but this one, I mean, I think this one was easily larger than any of those.
As big as you've seen. I want to remind listeners that you can call in with your thoughts and questions on these stories. Call us at 801-355-8255. You can also comment at sltrib.com. Okay, well, maybe a message sent by this rally, and we'll see whether it gets received during the session. Let's move on to some other topics. On the public lands front, Dan Harry, we learned yesterday that Speaker of the House Greg Hughes is the sponsor of a resolution having to do with the Bears Ears National Monument. What does this resolution say?
I'm not familiar with the specifics of that resolution, but in caucus, the Republicans discussed this. They want to pass a resolution, asking the president to rescind the Bears Ears National Monument and to shrink the boundaries of the 20, almost 21-year-old now, Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. And, you know, it's a non-binding resolution. It doesn't have any impact, but what they're hoping is that it sends an administration that at least the Republican-controlled legislature and the governor are behind this effort and that they want to be heard. It's untested legally. There has never been a presidential revocation of a national monument. There is not specific authority to do that in the Antiquities Act that's been around since 1906. So it's uncharted legal waters, and I'm sure if the president does act to try to do that, I'm sure there will be some legal challenges to it.
How unusual. Yeah, so there are two separate measures up there. One is by by House Speaker Greg Hughes, which is to rescind the Bears Ears. Mike Noel, Representative Mike Noel from Kanab, has another that calls for the shrinking of the boundary size of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. How unusual is it for the Speaker of the House to unveil this kind of proposal? And Robert Gerke, that might be a question for you.
Well, I mean, and Dan could probably speak to this too, but typically the speaker, they'll sponsor usually sometimes one or two bills a session. Hardly ever do they sponsor anything, and when they do, it's because they're trying to make a point about their feelings about the significance of that issue. So, yes, I mean, it does matter. It is significant that the speaker is sponsoring this. I think it's also significant because the speaker, more than any of the other legislators, has ins with the Trump administration. You know, there was talk about him getting a job with the administration. It looks like that's probably not going to happen. But he does have connections with the administration, particularly Donald Trump Jr., who's a big sort of outdoorsman. He's hunted in Utah and so forth. And so he does have that tie to the state. So, yeah, there is significance to the speaker's name being on there as the sponsor of the legislation.
You know, it's a resolution, and legislative resolutions are essentially sending a message. It's not anything that's binding. It's the lawmaking body going on record, right?
I mean, it is making a statement on behalf of the elected officials of the state, and you know, they make many of these every year, and typically they don't have a whole lot of impact. But it does, as you said, put them on record and put the position of this elected officials in the state in the record as far as supporting the repeal of the monument. And, you know, frankly, if you're the Trump administration and if this is something that you're looking to do, it does say you can then go out and say, well, the elected officials of the state, the congressional delegation is on board with this as well. The elected officials of the state are in favor of us rescinding this monument, and so we're going to go ahead and do it, and it gives you some cover in that regard.
And will they pass it? I mean, do you think that they will pass both of these?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it'll probably pass, if not on a party-line vote, close to a party-line vote, with the Republicans in both chambers overwhelmingly supporting it.
Okay. Some other things to dig through here, and I doubt we're going to be able to get to everything that's going on up at the legislature, but we'll try. The so-called Zion Curtain, the partition behind which alcoholic beverages are mysteriously mixed and poured in Utah restaurants, that could be going away this session, maybe. Dan Harry?
As Robert had in his column today, if you have a chance to read that in the Tribune, there's some opposition among Senate leadership. So this has some powerful supporters. We've got the House Majority Leader Brad Wilson and Jerry Stevenson, who has kind of become the new godfather of liquor laws in the state. And they're both backing this proposal to do away with the Zion Curtain.
As is the governor.
Mentioned it in his State of the State, which was very unusual. But then yesterday, the Senate leaders said that they have some opposition to it and think it could damage what are the best alcohol laws on the planet, I believe, is what Stuart Adams called it. And, you know, it's interesting that their philosophy is that if this mixing and pouring of alcohol in restaurants is hidden from children, that it will help keep down the rate of underage drinking. You know, I've always in my life observed that things that are more mysterious are usually the ones that attract kids to want to try. So I'm not sure that there is evidence to back up the theories behind the Zion Curtain.
And I think Stuart Adams may have been wrong about Utah having the best on the planet. I think Iran actually has a lower rate of youth drinking, but we're a close second in that regard. So maybe we just need to start cutting people's hands off. But there is this growing groundswell. This is something that's repealing the Zion or tearing down the Zion Curtain is something that they've been pushing for years now. And finally, it looks like maybe they have a trade-off to get this across the finish line.
What's that trade?
Well, there's a few pieces of it. One of the big pieces is they'll increase the markup on liquor. Right now, there's a statutory 86% markup from wholesale to retail on liquor. They'd go up to 87%. Not a huge increase, but it would generate, I believe, several hundred thousand dollars in money for anti-drinking programs, education, and so forth. They would phase out some of the licenses that the legislators are concerned about that blur the lines between the bars and the restaurants. They would create a buffer zone around the bar, because right now if you're at the restaurant with your kids, the kids can't sit at the bar. If this passes, there would be a 10-foot buffer around the bar where the kids can't be, which, you know, the idea is the same as sort of the Zion Curtain. It's like you'd separate them from the preparation and consumption of the alcohol. And then there was one other piece
The buffer, would that be like an architectural feature as well?
No, just sort of a no-go zone.
It's an imaginary wall.
A no-fly zone.
Got
yeah.
it, got it. Yeah. Well, there's also a proposal, and I don't know if this is tied to the kind of bargain you're talking about being struck, but there's a proposal to lower the legal blood alcohol limit for drivers. Is that tied to this at all?
Yeah, that's going to move separately. It's not part of the legislation that Representative Wilson, Senator Stevenson are talking about. And that one will just kind of move on its own merits, I think. The law enforcement community is a little bit apprehensive about it. They're not going to be opposing it there, but they do say that, you know, enforcing that is difficult because, you know, if you're a cop out on the street and you see somebody weaving, you're going to pull them over, and it's still going to be the same standard of, you know, you're driving poorly and so I'm pulling you over. It's not going to actually change on the enforcement side, but there would be additional. You know, if you blow a .06, you're going to get hit with a DUI as opposed to .08. There's, you know, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers nationally has opposed this, but you know, there is some support locally for it.
Okay. You know, we talked about the legislature being 76% male. It's also 88% or nearly 90% Mormon.
Yeah.
Has the LDS Church weighed in on this? Last year, they said that the state's alcohol laws should be left alone. They were fine as they are.
I don't think they've actually taken a position on the Wilson-Stevenson legislation at this point because we haven't actually seen the legislation. It's sort of conceptual still. Their position, once the legislation comes out, will be important. But I think that, you know, I think you can expect that they're going to probably oppose getting rid of the Zion Curtain. But at this point, I'm not sure that it matters, given the support that it has from the governor and from these legislative leaders.
Brad Wilson indicated in an interview with one of my reporters the other day he didn't say the church said okay on this, but he got all kinds of indications that they would not oppose this.
Right,
this
and matter. Neutrality often is the best you can expect on these bills.
Well, I'm sure that if the Zion Curtain does come down, we can see some ceremonial demolition events at restaurants if it gets passed. We'll see if that happens.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Exactly. Listeners and guys, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about a few more items from the legislature and then turn to testimony in the John Swallow trial, actually in a hearing in advance of the John Swallow trial. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a minute.
This week in This American Life, Blake's friend Camille sent him an old photograph of herself. In it, she's a little kid on vacation with her family in Canada.
And then I glanced back at the picture, and I saw my grandma walking through behind her.
Blake and Camille grew up in different states. Camille didn't know him at that age or his grandma. Coincidences, do they mean anything this week?
Join us Saturday morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Imagine a world without borders. Nations spend so much time and energy policing and controlling borders at the cost of so much human suffering. Why should so many people's fates be determined by the place they were born? Rethinking Borders, next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI.
Join us Sunday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Tom Harvey, Jessica Miller, and Robert Gerke. Join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. That's 801-355-8255. Robert Gerke, we were talking about the Zion Curtain before we went to the break, and you wrote about something else that has frequently not gone anywhere at the legislature, yeah. and that this year might have a chance, hate crimes legislation. Utah does have something on the books on this already, doesn't it?
Yeah, we've had a law on the books since 92, and it's been revised, I think it was in the early 2000s, Dan may know. They took a crack at revising it. It's still, prosecutors say that it's the law that we have on the books is completely unworkable because it requires that you show that there was somebody was targeted because of their race, gender, ethnicity, whatever, you know, all those protected classes, and that it was done to try to deny somebody access to a constitutional right, which is just sort of, it's a really high burden. And prosecutors have complained for years that it's unworkable. It almost passed last year, but the church came out and said, not specifically to hate crimes, but on issues relating to LGBT issues generally, said that we need to just kind of wait because they had passed the anti-discrimination ordinance or the anti-discrimination law a year before. They wanted to just have like a cooling off and a status quo for a year. This year, they've rebranded it. Now it's called a selection of victims. But if you select a victim based on those protected categories, it can be charged as a hate crime. Essentially, it can be escalated in terms of the severity of the charge. So there is actually a potential this year. We have heard, that the church is staying on the sidelines on this. The supporters of the bill say that they think that there's nothing that the church would object to. And if the church stays on the sideline, there's a potential that this will pass. Last year, Senator Urquhart, who was sponsoring the hate crimes bill, said when the church came out with their statement, he lost between 3 and 5 votes. Some of those have already come back, I guess, in support of the bill now. And so there is a potential that given that this, again, is the top priority of the prosecutors and the police chiefs and others in the law enforcement community, that this will actually get across the finish line.
But a new way of describing it, I mean, a victim selection as opposed to hate crimes legislation. This is something that Salt Lake District Attorney Sim Gill had said he couldn't prosecute before because apparently as it stood on the books, hate crimes laws were not clear enough, I guess.
Yeah. For example, they point to this case. It was December 2015, I guess, and there were these two guys from Wyoming that jumped these two gay male individuals after a party one night, beat them just severely, and it was clear from they were using slurs and so forth during the attack, but they couldn't charge it because these two guys weren't necessarily exercising a constitutional right. So the attack was not done to deny them access to a constitutional right other than, I guess, living. This is the problem with the way the law is structured now. And that constitutional right provision is something that LeVar Christensen, who is sort of the king of the right wing in the social conservative world, added to the bill, and it's just made it completely unworkable for prosecutors. So they need to. They say that, and this is the prosecutors. I mean, this is not Robert Gerke talking here. The prosecutors say they need to clarify this and to make sure that they have a bill that's workable and that they can use in these cases when they arise. They're rare. They're not frequent, and I believe that the court system said there would only be about 3 cases a year that would be successfully prosecuted under this new bill. But that's 3 cases that aren't being prosecuted now.
Today, has Senator Thatcher's bill had a hearing yet? Have we seen it advance at all?
No, I think the hearing is coming up. I believe he said it could be up next week, and I think it's in the committee that he's on. I think it'll be in law enforcement, criminal justice.
Okay. Well, 40 days remaining in the session for that to play out.
Yeah, there's still some time for it.
Tom Harvey, courts and government reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll leave the legislature behind for now, or will we, actually? There was testimony in a hearing this week ahead of the pending trial of former Utah Attorney General John Swallow. This was testimony by Mark Sessions Jensen. He said something that was unexpected, and it has to do with current Utah House Speaker Greg Hughes. First off, though, maybe remind us about this case. What is the former attorney general accused of, and how is this Mark Sessions Jensen involved?
Well, we're about 10 days away from the trial,
right.
The start of the trial now in the John Swallow case. And he is facing 13 charges, mostly felonies. I think there's maybe one misdemeanor in there. And they revolve around allegations of public corruption. There's the one subject of the hearing that you were speaking about had to do with the state's racketeering law called I think it's referred to as operation of a continuing criminal enterprise or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then he's also facing charges of bribery, tampering with evidence, and some other related counts like that.
Okay. So there was this hearing in advance of the trial, and Jensen, in his testimony, said that at a meeting at a luxury resort near Newport Beach, California, where he was renting villas, the current Speaker of the House at the time, he wasn't, Greg Hughes, was present. And Hughes adamantly denies that, and let's get into that in just a moment. But what was this meeting? And Tom, was it an alleged meeting? I'm not sure how to characterize it. What was it supposed to be about?
Well, there was people there. Now former Attorney General Mark Shurtleff was there. Swallow was there. Mark Jensen was there. There was some other businessman there. There was Mark Shurtleff's alleged the guy who called himself the fixer. Tim Lawson was there, and so there was a group of people meeting down there. And at that time, this is where we're talking 2009. Okay. I think this was June of 2009. But the question that came up was there these other with the UTA people? Were they there at the same time? And you know, what were they there for? And things like that.
Was Hughes a board member at UTA at the time, or was he was?
I think he was a board member at that time, and I think he became chairman of the board. But I don't think that was
in
until
2010.
You're right. Till the next year.
Okay. Yeah. And as you said, also present was a Jensen's business partner, Mark Robbins, I think.
Correct. Yeah.
And and he says that just to get this out of the way, he says that Jensen says that Robbins, Swallow, Shurtleff, and I'm guessing Hughes in this instance, in the same visit to California, met with Nevada Senator and then Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, though not at this luxury resort. Reid's name has been brought up in this case before in allegations from another businessman connected to the former Attorney General Jeremy Johnson, right?
That's correct, and who's also scheduled to testify in the Swallow trial too. So that could be interesting. His Johnson's though allegations about Reid didn't have anything to do with this the UTA or anything
okay.
like that. So that had to do with some. You know, allegations of alleged bribery or attempted alleged bribery.
Okay. Well, getting back to the present day, day two of this year's meeting of state lawmakers, and the House Speaker's name is dropped in this hearing. Hughes, in very strong terms, said that this was all fiction, right?
Yeah, that's right. So my colleague Jennifer Dobner was tweeting, pretty much live tweeting the whole hearing, and once she put that out, it just kind of this Twitter storm erupted, and one of them was Greg Hughes saying that it's absolutely not true, absolutely not true. And then so later he issues a statement. Later he goes before the House Republican caucus, says the same thing, and then
got a standing ovation.
And they're good at those. But he said he's willing to go down and testify to try to clear his name of this whole thing. He had nothing to do with it.
After the session's done, though, right? That's what I remember reading somewhere.
Yeah, that's correct. He said the day after, he said that. Yeah, he would be willing to testify, but he has this constitutional duty now to the legislature, to the people of Utah, to see this the session through to the end.
There's got to be a session joke to make there, but I can't get there. Listeners, call us with your thoughts on the stories that we are covering from this past week at 801-355-TALK or comment at sltrib.com.
If I could just jump in here on this Jensen testimony thing, because I was surprised to hear Greg Hughes's name dropped into this thing, because I had met with Jensen three times for over 5 hours total, interviewed him during our reporting on this, and he never mentioned Greg Hughes or Harry Reid in any of this. And I guess Jensen's testimony was that he didn't know it was Greg Hughes until he saw a picture of him last year, I guess. And Greg Hughes has offered some proof, I guess, that he wasn't there. I mean, in the March when they went down there in May, I guess it was, he was at a Gold Gloves tournament up here in Utah. And so I have serious doubts, frankly, about whether Greg was there or not. And if he wasn't, then you've got to question what the impact is of that is going to be on the trial, because you have a witness now, one of your chief witnesses at least, whose credibility is already in question because he's a convicted felon, and now is further in question because he's providing testimony on the stand that can be rebutted. Mark Shurtleff, I talked to him yesterday again about this, and he said that he, you know, Greg was never down there. There was no meeting.
Tom Harvey, does this bode ill for prosecutors? I mean, is that?
Well, yeah, the potential is there that it could. So now you have the Swallows defense attorney, Scott C. Williams, who is saying he's going to call Hughes to the stand. He's going to call Shurtleff to the stand. And he said that there are others who had contacted him, too, to say that they're willing to testify that this is absolutely not true. And we don't know who those others are. But it could. I mean, Jensen is a really key figure in this whole trial, and if his testimony is rebutted or shown to be false, or there is no other evidence to back up what he's saying, I think it could damage the case.
There's a whole side story here about a UTA frontrunner station and what happened there. It's kind of hard to dig into. But
do we have another hour to tell you?
Probably not. But Mark Shurtleff, as you said, this is John Swallow's predecessor. He showed up at this hearing, I guess, to watch or to be present during this testimony, as he was watching, I think, the live tweets from Jennifer Doudna as well. He also said that Hughes wasn't at this meeting. He called Jensen a liar to Jennifer when she saw him in the hallway, to the reporter, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jennifer Doudna.
Yes, yeah, and he's repeated it several times since then. Yeah, he definitely, in no uncertain terms, says that Jensen was lying about this. And I have to say, at least, we're not aware of any other evidence to support that claim at this point.
When does the Swallow trial start again?
February 7th.
When does the movie come out?
It'll be in Sundance next year, right?
Yeah, Robert, this story has played out as it's got to be one of the top stories of the past, I don't know, 10 years in terms of it's a behemoth story.
Yeah, so many moving pieces to this. I mean, you mentioned the UTA thing. I mean, that in itself was a big story when it happened, and then it kind of became part of this narrative involving John Swallow. I mean, the allegation is that there was some insider dealing and wheeling and dealing on the UTA thing, and then the Attorney General's office sat on the case, basically. And there was a state audit that referred it to the AG's office for criminal investigation, and then really not much happened for, I think, 4 or 5 years before the AG's chief deputy, Kirk Torgensen, referred it to the federal to federal investigators about a year and a half ago. So presumably, I mean, we don't have any indication that case is closed. It may still be ongoing, but that we're talking about a 7-year-old case now. So, yeah, I mean, it's just the moving pieces to this, as Tom knows well, are just it's sort of overwhelming sometimes to try to keep track of the players and the pieces and the dealings that have been alleged.
Lots of coverage on the story for years now at sltrib.com. Check it out. We're going to have to take another quick break here on Behind the Headlines. When we come back, Salt Lake City rebuffs the Trump administration over immigration enforcement policy. Also, the release of body cam footage from a high-profile police shooting last year. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a minute.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll traverse many of the original 7 Celtic nations and venture beyond. for lilting Celtic melodies from Africa, Italy, Canada, and Spain. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join me for Celtic Around the World, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us this Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Next time on Ask Me Another, we know you go down television streaming wormholes. We know you're feeling separation anxiety from your remote control. You know what? We're going to reward your winter television dependency because we have actor Zazie Beetz, who stars on the Golden Globe-winning television series Atlanta. So join me, Ophira Eisenberg, on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Join us Saturday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jessica Miller, Dan Harry, Tom Harvey, and Robert Gerke. Join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or comment at sltrib.com. Turning away from the legislature and the courts right now, let's turn to another story altogether, and Jessica Miller. Body cam footage was released from a police shooting that took place near to the Salt Lake City homeless shelter last year. Footage was released this week, 11 months after the incident occurred. Why was it released now?
So after District Attorney Sim Gill cleared these officers of this shooting, they charged the person who was shot, Abdi Muhammad, a 17-year-old boy, with aggravated robbery and drug distribution charges for a fight that occurred before the shooting happened. And so he was in court this week for a preliminary hearing, and as part of that hearing, the prosecutors showed that body cam footage in court. And so, during all this time, Sim Gill has said, we can't release this footage. It could affect his rights to a fair trial. And then on Tuesday, after this, these videos were shown in court, he said, well, this was a public courtroom. The defense attorneys didn't object. And so now is the time to make it public.
There was a conversation. The ACLU had been trying to get this footage released, as you said. The State Records Committee sided with the ACLU and said that this should be released. And the district attorney originally said he was going to plan or appeal that decision. But because of this trial is what you're saying, it's essentially now that it's been shown in court, it's OK for it to go forward.
Yeah, that's what he said, which is kind of interesting that, that records committee hearing wasn't that long ago. It was just a couple weeks ago. And so, the prosecutors knew that this preliminary hearing was coming up. So I'm not really sure what changed, where at first they were saying we're going to appeal, and now they just distributed it. So
maybe just the fact that it was aired in the courtroom. I don't know.
I guess so.
This is going to be a little bit hard to condense, I think, but what does this footage show?
It shows throughout this time, Sim Gill kind of gave this narrative of what had happened. And then we had the Salt Lake City Civilian Board who gave a narrative as well. And it pretty much matches what they were saying, that it shows these two officers there investigating a cell phone theft, a totally unrelated thing. And they saw this fight going on. And so they run towards Abdi and this other man. And they're yelling at him to drop. He's got this broom handle, and they're yelling at him to drop drop your weapon, drop it, drop it, drop it. They say it like 10 or 15 times. It's probably about 15 seconds between when they start yelling at him, and he doesn't really respond. And then they shoot him a couple times, and he falls on the ground, and he's laying there on the ground for about 5 or 6 minutes without any aid because this crowd kind of gathers of all these people near the homeless shelter who are yelling at the police officers. And so
chaos kind of ensues.
Okay.
The Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill ruled the use of deadly force in this incident legally justified. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the conclusion of the Police Civilian Review Board, though.
Yeah, they found that the officers were not within policy. And the moment that what's kind of critical is right before they fire the weapon, Abdi is kind of moving his hands. And so the officer saying, Sim Gill said that he was moving this broomstick like up as if he was going to strike the victim, where the civilian board found that he just was walking with a pace where his arms were kind of moving up and down because he kind of had a determined pace. And so he wasn't raising the weapon. He was just walking. So I guess it just depends on whatever you conclusion you come to after watching it.
Selective perception.
Exactly.
Activists, among them members of the group Utah Against Police Brutality, said that the footage ran counter to what they had been told initially by prosecutors and police, right?
Right. And it's pretty much that moment where you can look at it and say, well, was he really raising that stick to strike this victim again? They look at it and say, no, he wasn't. And then you have, you know, people with like the Fraternal Order of Police, they look at it and they say, well, he definitely was attacking this victim and was pretty intent on violence. And this was the only way that the police could stop that.
Robert Gerke, I'd like to bring you in on this. Does this difference in who saw what in this body cam footage reinforce the idea that this sort of thing should be made public so that the public can decide for itself? Or, you know, I'm imagining that's what the ACLU would argue anyways.
Right. I mean, the idea behind body cams is once you have a clear video of what happened, then everybody will agree that what happened happened. But everybody sees the video differently now and interprets it differently. And police, as Jessica mentioned, the Fraternal Order of Police are going to obviously see it in a way that is favorable to the police officer. But I think that it's important, I think, if nothing else, that we're having this discussion now and people can actually speak about it without, you know, conjecture about what might have been in the video and so forth. And so I think the release of the video was probably overdue. And I think it's actually beneficial. And I don't see how it's necessarily hurt a case or could have hurt the case by having, you know, by the public having seen this earlier. It's kind of a shame that that took such a battle to try to get it to get the DA's office to release it, I think.
Is there a different public expectation of transparency for body cam footage than there is for other, forms of evidence? We're talking about deadly force here, I guess, and that's maybe why this is different.
Well, initial contact reports under the open records law are always public, and I think this is the argument that the press made, is that this is sort of an initial contact. And so I think there is an expectation, particularly in a high-profile event like this, when we're talking about lethal force, especially when that's such a major topic of discussion around the country, that, you know, there's a compelling public interest, I think, in releasing this in releasing this footage. And you know, I think it's beneficial. I think, as Jessica mentioned, that now everybody can draw their own opinion on whether the police acted appropriately or not, as opposed, again, to having just sort of speculation.
I'm going to throw out our phone number for listener comment, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Jessica, Abdi Mohammed, the boy who was shot back in February of last year, he's now 18 years old. What comes next for him? I know he's facing some charges stemming from this incident. What are those?
Yeah, so like I mentioned earlier, it's an aggravated robbery and drug distribution charges. The allegation is that before this person that he was in a fight with, that he was trying to rob him of like $1.10 that this person had, and he had drugs that he was trying to sell. So that's the allegation. So at this preliminary hearing this week, the judge found that there was probable cause for the case to move forward. So now what happens next month at a hearing, the judge will hear more evidence and she'll decide whether it's most appropriate for the case to stay in juvenile court or whether it should go to the adult system. And if it goes to the adult system, then he faces the same penalty that you would as if you were an adult. So an aggravated robbery charge, that's a 15 to life possible sentence if he's convicted.
And he's wheelchair bound as a result of this? Is that of the shooting?
Yeah, he is right now.
Okay. Well, reporting by Jessica Miller on this story can all be found at the Salt Lake Tribune's website, and you can see the footage that we've been discussing yourself, though note that it does have graphic and violent content. SLTrib.com is the website. You know, let's turn to another story, or try and sandwich in a couple of more stories before we turn to our underplayed stories of the week, and maybe we'll turn to Dan Harry. Salt Lake City is challenging our new president's position on immigration, and in particular on immigration enforcement. Yesterday, there was a press conference with city leaders, law enforcement officials, even some state lawmakers. What was their message to the Trump administration?
Well, the message was that our local police officers do not enforce immigration law, And this has been quite a long-standing policy. It certainly predates Mayor Biskupski, but she is sticking with that policy. And the idea is that from the police point of view is that if you start acting as immigration officers on behalf of the federal government, that you will immediately lose the trust of a significant part of the community, undocumented people, and that they will not report other crimes, which fosters more crime. And so that's been their policy for quite some time. They're continuing that policy, and they just called this news conference to say, we're not a so-called sanctuary city, we're a welcoming city. But I think the main distinction, as I understand it, is that the city doesn't control its own jail. The county does. So their message was that, you know, we're going to stick with our policies, that we are not an arm of the federal government, and we are not going to be arresting people for not having documentation.
This enforcement of immigration violations was something that was the subject, and Robert Gehrke, you might be able to talk on this, wasn't this the subject of some legislation at the Utah State Legislature not too many years ago that was then challenged in the courts?
You're talking about the guest worker program that the state tried to institute, and basically.
Show me your papers, I think.
It's a little bit different. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's new. It's not at all the same thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was that legislation that was proposed. It was dependent on, I guess, the federal waiver that they didn't get, and so they ended up just shelving it, basically. And then and there was also a court challenge over Arizona's bill that was comparable. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the press conference yesterday was in response to some things that the president has announced in the past few days: building a wall along the border, stepping up deportations, indefinitely blocking the resettlement of Syrian refugees, and halting for a time the resettlement of all refugees, in addition to halting immigration from predominantly Muslim countries: Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. Robert Gehrke, this is President Trump making good on a campaign promise, I suppose, but critics look at refugees and say these guys are fleeing terror, not causing it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you can't be too surprised that he did this, because he said for months that this was what he was going to do, and so now we're seeing the rubber meet the road, I think, and unfortunately, it's affecting a lot of these. Particularly in the case of refugees, I don't think there are many examples, if any examples, of refugees actually causing violence in this country, but there is the concern, and so now he's going to cut off that. He's going to the construction of the wall that he's trying to initiate is going to be a big issue going forward, and funding that is with a tariff of 20% on imports from Mexico, I think he's going to run into some problems with his own party on this, especially representatives from Texas and border states. But that seems to be the direction he's headed.
Dan Harry, there was a poll that came out, and it showed that Utahns are in opposition to Trump's plan to curtail refugee immigration to the state,
right.
By some margin.
55% said that, which some observers have said that was surprisingly low. Utah has been a standout as welcoming refugees. The governor, Governor Gary Herbert, was the only Republican governor when there was this kind of furor over ending resettlement of refugees in states. He was the only governor who said, I'm going to buck the trend of Republican governors, and we will welcome the Syrian refugees here and continue to do so. He didn't respond yesterday when we asked him to comment on the president's plan and our poll. He said he wanted the official order to be out there so he can look at the language. Hopefully today he'll answer some questions about that.
Okay. Well, there is actually a lot of opinion. There's a lot of polling that was done at the Salt Lake Tribune's website, including whether or not Hatch should run for re-election, a number of other issues. But unfortunately, we don't have time to get to that today. You can check it out at sltrib.com. And guys, we're out of time, and so we need to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. And Tom Harvey, have you got one ready by any chance?
I just wanted to I don't have a specific one, but I wanted to make a I guess, a personal plea for more national and international news on the Salt Lake Tribune front page. I think just given the fact that our new president is so different than both Republican and Democratic presidents that we've had for decades now, and seems intent on overturning some of the established thinking and order, that I'd just like to see more stories on our front page that put some context in all of this.
All right, a plea from Tom Harvey. Dan Harry, how about yourself for an underplayed story of the week?
I will mention an audit that came out yesterday that really dinged the anti-discrimination agency in Utah, and it was pretty bad. It says investigators there have no formal training. They find a merit in a case of discrimination in, I believe, one out of 225 cases that they take up. And that's far lower than surrounding states. It's lower than the EEOC, the federal agency. And so it really begs the question of, is there bias against workers and for employers going on in the agency that's supposed to investigate that kind of discrimination, race, gender, sexual orientation, age, those kinds of things.
Okay. And again, you can check out that reporting on that audit at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, underplayed story of the week.
Yeah. I mean, mine's not necessarily underplayed. I tend to do that a lot, I guess. But and it's not local. But, you know, the passing of Mary Tyler Moore.
Sure.
She was an icon, of a feminist icon. She was an inspiration to, I think, journalists coming up, you know, with her role in the TV show. And it's a real loss. It's sort of an end of an era, I think, in with her passing this week.
Absolutely. Okay. And Jessica Miller, your underplayed story of the week.
So I'm picking a developing story right now. Apparently there was a fire in Sandy at their public works maintenance complex this morning that caused millions of dollars in damage and apparently burned half of their snowplows.
Oh, no.
They have 20 snowplows. Now they're down to 10 because half of them burned in a fire overnight.
And that could wreak havoc with any coming storms.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of torn here. I guess I'll go with Utah Jazz forward Gordon Hayward being chosen as a Western Conference All-Star. Though, actually, for my second pick, check out former Mexican President Vicente Fox's Twitter feed. If you haven't seen it yet, you won't be disappointed. Okay, well, Salt Lake Tribune news editor Dan Harry, reporters Tom Harvey, Jessica Miller, and columnist Robert Gerke, thank you very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines today.
Great. Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
My apologies to Robert Kirby and his fans today, as I didn't leave enough time for his segment. We'll get back to the Kirby archives next week, though you can find all of his columns at sltrib.com, including one from yesterday where he says our next president should automatically be a woman. That does it for the show today. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and to the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. Thanks to you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this show at our website, kcpw.org, or through whatever you use to get podcasts on your smartphone or device. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks once again for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you again next Friday.
Four hours of reality. The Road Forward will take place at the Canyon Community Center in Springdale from Monday, December 5th through Tuesday. Listening to Utah Public Radio, statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.